We will go on the record and come to order. The Commission is hereby convened in open session January 17, 2013, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus Consolidation Coal Company, docket number WEVA 2009-371. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Nakamura. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Beth Ebner. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning. CONSOL operates the Robinson Run Mine, an underground coal mine located in Marion County, West Virginia. The Robinson Run Mine liberates over a million cubic feet of methane in a 24-hour period and is subject to a five-day spot inspection under the Mine Act. At the hearing, CONSOL stipulated to all the violations. On appeal, CONSOL only challenges the S&S unwarrantable designation and negligence findings where applicable. Because five violations are involved here, but we're going to take these one by one. The first violation I will address is the accumulation violation. On August 18, 2008, MSHA Inspector Aaron Wilson issued order number 608537 under Section 104B2 of the Mine Act. Because he discovered loose coal and coal fines in nature accumulated under the 14A coal conveyor belt at the 90 block for a distance of 17 feet. The accumulations were up to 1 foot and were in contact with the belt for a short distance. The accumulations were also piled up around the tail roller for a height of 20 inches across the 62-inch tail roller. Although the accumulations were wet in nature, the order stated that they were starting to dry out and the tail roller was warm to the touch. The inspector also observed that the accumulations were present on top of the feeder in the form of fine and local coal, dry in nature, 55 inches in length, and up to 2 feet high. The inspector was accompanied by CONSOL Representative Larry Jones, who immediately shut down the belt when he saw the condition. The inspector was also accompanied by a UMWA safety representative who testified at the hearing. The inspector checked three shift books and learned that the spillage, or that spillage, at this location had been noted in the book for five prior shifts. It took five miners over 2 hours to abate the condition. Based on the operator's stipulation, Judge Miller found a violation. She concluded that the violation was S&S, reasoning that the violation created a discrete safety hazard, which was the risk of smoke and fire in an underground mine environment, and that this hazard would result in an injury that would have to be serious or potentially fatal in nature. The judge found the violation to be a result of unwarranted failure because the accumulations were extensive, obvious, existing for an extended period of time. She also relied on the pre-shift report, which should have put management on notice that greater attention to the condition was needed. Further, she relied on the extensive history of accumulation violations at the mine, which also should have put CONSOL on notice of the recurring safety problem. The judge raised the penalty from $6,105 proposed by the secretary to $7,500, stating that the penalty should be modified to reflect exposure of the entire crew, not just the two persons the secretary listed as being affected, as well as the negligence and gravity of the accumulation. On appeal, CONSOL argues that the judge erroneously refused to consider evidence of additional safety measures, such as fire suppression systems, which she made her S&S designation. CONSOL asserts that the judge should have considered the wet nature of the accumulation, which rendered it non-combustible. As to the unwarrantable designation, CONSOL argues that the judge erred by disregarding that CONSOL had a cleanup plan and was actively trying to prevent accumulation. CONSOL also asserts that there is ample evidence to prove that the accumulations that were reported for the several ships were actually separate, distinct spillages on different dates. The secretary, on the other hand, responds that under commission precedent, no weight should be given to redundant safety measures when evaluating S&S. Further, as to the wetness of the coal, The judge expressly credited the inspector and the UMWA rep's testimony that the accumulations were drying out, and even console's witnesses conceded that the coal was in contact with the belt bearing. With respect to unwarrantable failure, the secretary argues that the judge properly found that the violation was extensive, obvious, and dangerous, and that the violation existed over five shifts, and that console was aware of the violative condition from the pre-shift report and its extensive history of violations, which should have engendered that greater efforts were necessary. And so we'll stop there and for Commissioner Hughes.
Thank you, Beth. Commissioner Nakamura is going to address the case first.
Yes, thank you. I would, on this violation, affirm the findings of both significant and substantial and unwarrantable failure. I believe that there is substantial evidence in the record to support both of the judge's findings. I agree with the judge's framing of the hazard in this case as accumulations of coal which were in contact with the belt and the tail roller, creating a risk of smoke and fire. I think there's ample evidence in the record to support the judge's finding, particularly with respect to the coal in the tail roller, that there was a reasonable likelihood that there could be combustion and resulting in smoke and fire. The record reflects that, and the judge so found that the coal, I guess, in the tail roller itself, I guess, was warm to the touch. Although the coal, I guess, in general was wet, the coal in and around the tail roller had begun to dry out, and I guess there were areas that were dry. So based on that finding, I would first of all affirm the S&S finding. I reject the employer's, the operator's argument regarding the redundant safety measures. And based on the reasoning in the Seventh Circuit Buck Creek Coal case, which we have, the reasoning in which we have adopted in commission precedent. I think the reasoning, in that case, the operator had argued that we have all these other measures which would prevent or at least mitigate the possibility that a fire could occur. But I think the Seventh Circuit in that case said that it doesn't make sense to make that argument because the precautions, these other redundant precautions are presumably in place because precisely because of the significant dangers associated with coal mine fires. So, again, I reject the operator's argument regarding these redundant measures. With respect to unwarrantable failure, I also would affirm the judge. She did touch on all the seven factors that we have set out in our previous cases. She did make, there was a dispute regarding the length of time, I guess, the accumulations had existed. She made credibility determinations based on the evidence, which I think are supported by substantial evidence. The finding is particularly supported by the pre-shift books showing that there was accumulations in the pre-shift book five shifts prior to when the citation was issued. I think evidence is compelling that the coal around the tail rollers was compacted, which certainly is evidence that accumulations had existed at least for some length of time. And again, on the other issues, the extent of the violations, it took 4 to 5 miners 2.5 hours to abate the conditions. There is evidence of numerous violations. She cited to several exhibits in the record, which reflect violations in a short period of 100 violations, I guess, in a short period of time. And no corrective action taken. There was knowledge because the pre-shift books were signed by the operator, and yet no corrective action taken. And I think there's certainly evidence supporting that the condition is obvious. And I think there may have actually been, if I recall correctly, testimony or an admission by one of the operator's witnesses that, yeah, you could see the accumulations. That was not an issue, and of course the danger is supported by her findings with respect to SNS. So on this particular violation, I would affirm with respect to both SNS and unwarrantable failure.
Thank you, Commissioner Nakamura. We'll now hear from Commissioner Young.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree generally with Commissioner Nakamura, in particular concerning the analysis of the unwarrantability. I had some questions about some of the accumulations, because if it's present for 5 shifts and it's still drying out, that's a long time for coal to dry if it's on its way to becoming dry. But when you have coal compacted by a roller, in contact with a roller, built up around the belt, and heat starting to develop there, that's the type of accumulation case that I believe MSHA has made a special point of emphasis of, and that we have even recently not even granted review on these issues, because we've seen almost this identical case come before us where it turns on credibility determinations and the inspector's findings of these very conditions. And I think it's clearly supported by the record and by substantial evidence as cited by the judge in this case on the unwarrantability and also on the S&S. In terms of the increase in the penalty, the judge explained the criteria and justified her decision appropriately, as the Act requires, and I think that should be affirmed as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. I also would agree with my colleagues and affirm the judge on the SNS and the unwarrantable failure issues, basically for the reasons that they've articulated. I think the aspects that would detract from the judge's findings that have been proposed to us by the operator are unpersuasive, either because of prior precedent or credibility findings that the judge made and the evidence in the record before the judge.
Do we have to, and I guess on the penalty increase, which is, I think, based on an abuse of discretion standard?
Yes.
I would find there's no abuse.
I would agree.
Okay, I'll state my position.
Right. The operator didn't contest the raises,
okay.
But just to be aware, if there was any modification, then we would have to.
Okay,
so moving on to the second violation, which is the panic bar violation. On September 4th, 2008, Inspector Wilson issued an SNS citation alleging a violation of Section 75.523-3B3 because the emergency brake on a scoop, when applied using the panic bar, did not engage and bring the equipment to a complete stop. The inspector gave the operator several attempts to engage the emergency brake, all to no avail. The panic bar is within easy reach of the scoop operator, who can operate it by hand. The panic bar is intended to stop the scoop in an emergency, but it also functions as a common way to shut down the scoop. The scoop had been used during the shift before to haul equipment and supplies to another area of the mine. The parties agreed that there was a violation, and the only issue before the judge was whether the violation was estimated. The judge determined that the safety hazard existed as a result of a violation, which was the danger of being unable to safely stop the equipment in an emergency. She went on to conclude that it was reasonably likely that the hazard created by the non-functioning panic bar would contribute to an injury in the event of an emergency. Crediting the testimony of Inspector Wilson that a miner directing the scoop or walking in the vicinity could be touched by the scoop operator was unable to engage the brakes via the panic bar, or that the scoop operator would be in danger if the scoop did not stop and ran into a wall or another piece of equipment. The judge assessed the same penalty proposed by the secretary, which was $1,203. On appeal, counsel argues that the judge erroneously assumed the occurrence of an emergency. Counsel asserts that the motorized scoop at issue was equipped with two primary braking systems and that each were operational. Counsel argues that in order to establish S&S, the secretary bore the burden of proving that each of the two operational braking systems would fail and that an emergency situation would occur that required the need of panic bar and to immediately stop the equipment, and that the inability to brake would reasonably likely result in an injury of a serious nature. The operator argues that in the absence of an emergency, there was little or no likelihood that the failure of the panic bar would cause an injury. The secretary responds that the primary purpose of an emergency brake is to stop vehicles when the primary brake is not. She urges accordingly that the only logical approach in evaluating the S&S nature of an emergency brake violation is to assume the occurrence of the emergency. She argues that her approach is consistent with the statutory language of the Mine Act and the Commission's precedent as set forth in emergency escapeway cases. And she submits that her approach is consistent with Massey, but if the Commission deems otherwise, the Commission must defer to her interpretation, as it is an ambiguous statutory provision. In addition, she points out that Inspector Wilson testified at length that the panic bar is commonly the first method the operator uses to stop their vehicle. So the violation is also S&S, even without considering the emergency, and that the case could be remanded under that theory. And so now we'll pick up the Commissioner's view.
I agree that the judge framed the hazard correctly as the danger of being unable to safely stop the equipment in an emergency. And based on our reasoning in the Cumberland Coal case, would find that the judge properly found that this particular violation was S&S. I think that's slightly different than what the secretary has asserted here of assuming the emergency, but I guess in defining what the hazard is under part two of the Matthews test, the panic bar, I think you can tell by the nickname it has, as is used in the event that you can't stop, and it better work. And the emergency being that you need to be able to stop in case that there's an accident might occur. And I think that in this particular case, the inspector was testing it on an incline. And this was the equipment we're talking about, I think, was a scoop, which was used in hauling both materials and equipment. So it's, you know, it has, although they go slowly, there's a lot of momentum behind it. because of the equipment and material. So the panic bar is important in a confined area such as a coal mine. And I think there's, if it fails, there certainly is a reasonable likelihood of a serious injury to either the, I think they were using a spotter, and so there is a miner out there when they're operating this equipment. And certainly there are cases where the operator himself or herself can get injured if the panic bar doesn't engage and there's some accident. So based on that reasoning, and our reasoning in Cumberland Coal, and I guess as borrowed from the TBS case, I would find SNS and affirm the judge.
Thank you, Commissioner McMoore. Commissioner Young?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. If the chairman agrees with Commissioner Nakamura, I think she's probably right as he laid it out for you. But I have some serious questions as to whether this is the type of emergency system that we're dealing with in the Cumberland case, i.e., a safety requirement that only serves a purpose in the event of a general emergency condition. This is in the nature of a redundant safety system. There are two other braking systems on the scoop, and I think in that event, I don't think you can just shorthand it and look at it from the standpoint of as I'm going to shorthand it now, assuming the emergency. I think that you have to look at it and go through the full Matthews analysis as we have traditionally done. Even so, though, in this case, I'm compelled by the testimony, which is supported by common sense and the design of the equipment, that the panic bar is frequently the first braking mechanism resorted to by miners because of its convenience and location and because of what the operator of the scoop might be doing at the time and whether he might rely on that first. And if you need to stop quickly or in a panic situation and it doesn't work, you may not have time to apply another braking mechanism. If I'm not mistaken, I believe we had a miner run over and killed in an underground mine by a scoop last year. And so there's clearly a potential deadly hazard involved here. And for that reason, I would hold that the braking systems ought to work, and that if you went through the full Matthews analysis in this particular case, you would find that there is a reasonable possibility that the hazard contributed to, i.e., a non-functioning braking system that should be relied upon or reliable, would not be available to the miner at a moment of need. Whether that arose because the other braking systems failed might have some bearing on the probability that it might occur, but to me it seems to be more of a threat and more of a present danger because of the possibility that the miner might rely on that system first and might not have time to try an alternative means of stopping the scoop. So I would affirm the S&S, but I will probably prefer to see it addressed differently than the judge chose to address it, and certainly differently than the secretary had suggested. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. I also would agree to affirm the judge's finding of S&S. I think I would be inclined to agree with the analysis by my colleague, Commissioner Nakamura, on this. For the time being, I think that, you know, I suppose an alternative approach in this case, if I have continued to examine the factual basis, the record here, but if this is a situation where the panic bar is were frequently used as kind of the first line of defense, so to speak, in stopping the equipment, or frequently, we could wind up with an approach where we need not, you know, even reach the other kind of analysis. But for now, in terms of drafting the decision, I would go along with Commissioner Nakamura's analysis.
Moving on to the third violation, which was the Bolter permissibility violation. On September 4th, 2008, Inspector Wilson observed a roof bolter on the 13A section not being maintained in a permissible condition in that there was an opening greater than 0.008 inch in the stepped flange joint in the permissible cover for the area light. The path must be 0.007 of an inch. The judge determined that the violation was S&S, reasoning that the safety hazard existed as a result of the violation to be the danger of allowing an ignition source to be available in this gassy mine. The judge concluded that given the location of the bolter and the fact that methane is often emitted as the bolter drills into the roof, it's highly likely that the ignition source in the light will be exposed to methane, thereby making ignition and subsequent explosions likely to occur. She found that given that the violation was on a bolter and the gassy nature of the mine, the likelihood of an explosion related to an ignition source provided by the roof bolter is greater than that of other equipment. Assuming continued course of mining, the judge found that there was a reasonable likelihood of permanently disabling or fatal injury as a result of the hazard caused by the permissibility violation. The judge assessed a penalty of $1,304, the same amount as proposed by the Secretary. On appeal, counsel argues that the judge erred by assuming that methane would be present despite the undisputed evidence that no methane was present and the equipment was not operational at the time. Counsel asserts that no expert testimony was presented at the hearing that the bolter was likely to release methane from the roof while performing bolting operations. And accordingly, the judge then based her decision on her own personal views and not upon properly presented evidence. The Secretary responds that the judge's S&S determination should be affirmed. Under Commission precedent, she argues, the presence of electrical equipment in permissible condition in the gassy mine has determined to be a possible ignition source for a methane explosion. Accordingly, she asserts that the presence of impermissible electrical equipment, as in the case at Barr, must be sufficient to establish S&S. The Secretary also responds that Inspector Wilson, whose testimony the judge accepted, testified that because the mine is a gassy mine and because of the location of the roof bolter, that there was a reasonable likelihood of an injury from an explosion despite no methane being detected at the time of the violation. The Secretary also argues that the permissibility requirements only protect miners in the event of an explosion within the enclosure box, and that such an explosion should be assumed in the S&S context. The Secretary also notes that she agrees with counsel that the judge has misstated Inspector Wilson's testimony about roof bolting and methane emission. Nonetheless, she called this mischaracterization a harmless error because Inspector Wilson's testimony supports the finding of a reasonable likelihood of a methane explosion. And accordingly, she urges the Commission to affirm the judge's S&S. Now, pick up with Commissioner Reed on the bolter permissibility.
On the permissible violation, I would also affirm the judge's finding of S&S. I know both sides discussed the case, old case of ours, Texas Gulf at 10 Femschrick 498, and I think in that case it involved a violation of a permissibility requirement, and the Commission recognized that permissibility violations have the potential for serious danger. In that particular case, the mine had no history of high methane concentrations at all. So I think that, or even histories of ignitions or explosions. So I think that case does not support the operator's arguments. And in fact, in this particular case, I mean, this is a gassy mine. And I'm not sure if in this particular, for this particular violation, but I know that for one of them, the citation was issued during the 5-day spot inspection required for a gassy mine. So, I mean, the record reflects, and I think is supported, and I don't think anybody's disputing that this is a gassy mine. I was somewhat troubled by the judge's, what the secretary says was a mischaracterization of where the methane, or she describing that the methane, I guess, is potentially coming from the drilling by the roof bolter. Which I get, and I don't think the inspector said that.
Yeah.
What I understand the inspector said was that the roof, this particular roof bolter, was in a long wall recovery area, so that the, you know, there was the gob where the coal, you know, falls in the long wall process. I guess it was far from the bleeder exhaust fan,
right.
And so there was the potential for methane, a pocket of methane, I guess, to come and migrate towards where the roof bolter was operating, and I didn't see that particular testimony disputed. So I would agree with this what the secretary says in her brief, that the judge's finding with respect to methane coming when the roof bolter was operating roof bolt as harmless error, and that there is substantial evidence supporting, I guess, her finding of S&S. And I don't buy the argument that just because there was no methane detected at that particular time, it's not S&S, because we have long-standing precedent that you look at the situation from the point of view of continuing mining operations. So again, I would affirm the S&S finding.
Thank you, Commissioner Nakamura. Commissioner Young?
Thank you. I would also affirm the judge on the S&S, not because, again, as the Secretary would have us assume that there's going to be an explosion within the box necessarily, but simply because safety standards serve a purpose, and in a gassy mine, the permissibility requirements become increasingly important for this very reason. It's not inconceivable, and it's certainly reasonable to think that it's possible that in a gassy mine, a machine in close proximity or to the gob, particularly where there are ventilation issues in the mine, I mean, they're having some difficulty with ventilation, that there's a potential there for methane in explosive levels to encounter a spark and not be contained within the machine as intended by the standard. So I would affirm the judge on the S&S.
I also would affirm the judge's S&S findings for the reasons set forth by my colleagues.
Okay, and now moving on to the first ventilation violation. On August 26, 2008, Inspector Wilson was on a 5-day spot inspection. This was the 5-day spot inspection, Commissioner Nakamura, and was checking air velocity. The inspector issued order number 6608544 for a section 75.370A1 violation, not following the approved ventilation plan on the 15A section. At the idle face of entry number 1, the inspector detected only 2,160 CFM of air being maintained when the mine ventilation plan stated that a minimum of 3,000 CFM will be maintained. The violation was admitted by counsel, and the judge found that the violation occurred as stated in the order. As to SNS, the judge found the discrete safety hazard as a result of the violation to be the danger of methane accumulation resulting in explosion. She went on to find that the hazard would result in an injury of a serious or fatal nature. The judge specifically credited the testimony of Inspector Wilson and MSHA ventilation specialist John Hayes that a hazard develops when methane accumulates in the idle areas and there is insufficient air to dilute it. She further found the testimony of UNWA member Ann Martin about the methane problems that Robinson Run was experiencing during the summer of 2008 to be corroborated. On the other hand, the judge did not credit the testimony of consul witnesses who believed that the violations were not SNS because there was some air movement and no ignition sources. On appeal, consul argues that the judge erred in finding SNS because there was not a sufficient confluence of factors to support a hazard of explosion. The evidence revealed that methane readings were 0.45%, and there was absolutely no explosive levels of methane present to cause an ignition. Consul also argues that the judge failed to consider the presence of methane monitors and the requirement that methane checks be performed prior to energizing equipment. The judge also ignored the evidence that 2,150 CFM was more than sufficient to dilute methane. Consul also posits that the judge disregarded that no mining was taking place and there was no energized equipment in the area. The secretary responds that consul overlooks well-established law that SNS determinations must be made assuming continued normal mining operations. She points to the substantial evidence that the mine is a gassy mine, that it was experiencing high levels of methane in the summer of 2008. Especially in the 15A section. The secretary also takes issue with consul's attempt to militate SNS finding by suggesting that redundant safety measures should somehow lessen the SNS finding and asserts that consul has not set forth any exceptional circumstances that would warrant disturbing the judge's credibility determination. As to unwarrantable failure, the judge found that the violation to be a result of unwarrantable failure. The judge credited the inspector's testimony that he had specifically communicated to mine management that he would take harsher action if non-compliance with the vent plan continued. She also based her determination on the previous violation history and that management had instituted nothing to prevent this condition on the idle working places from occurring. She found the violation to be obvious and posing a high level of danger. The judge did not credit the testimony of consul witnesses who did not recall the meeting with Wilson. She also concluded that consul's efforts consisted of only attempting to deal with a higher than normal methane liberation and did not address this portion of the vent plan dealing with idle places. In sum, the judge found all these factors added up to an unwarrantable failure violation. The judge assessed a penalty of $16,000 for the order. On appeal, consul argues that none of the unwarrantable factors were present. The violation is based upon the lack of a mere 840 CFM of air, which is very slight, so the violation was clearly not extensive. Consul argues that the violation only took 6 minutes to abate. Consul also argues that it took steps to ensure proper ventilation, such as installing larger vent fans, larger vent tubing, instructing the crews to de-energize when methane levels reach a 0.7% rather than the required 0.1%. Consul argues that the judge did not take these steps into consideration. Consul also asserts that there were many mitigating factors and the judge's findings were based on her distaste for consul's witnesses. The secretary responds that the judge specifically considered such mitigating evidence and rejected it because by consul's own admission, consul did not take any steps to address the problem of its chronic failure to comply with plan section 14D. The secretary also argues that consul's poor attitude toward safety and compliance with the vent plan section 14D was fully supported by the record, and the judge's findings do not in any way constitute bias. And now we'll pick it up with Commissioner Peters.
Okay. For many of the reasons I have articulated earlier, I would affirm the SNS finding. I think we have an early case, U.S. Steel Mining at 7 Femschrick, 1124, where there was insufficient air at the face in violation of a ventilation plan due to a downline curtain. And we found S&S because the particular mine in that case liberated methane and under normal mining conditions, methane liberation could be expected to continue and accumulate. Again, this was a gassy mine, and the judge, I guess 30%, it's actually a 30% reduction in the air. I'm not sure that is insignificant in this mine. I mean, the mine, the vent plan required 3,000, and this was in an idle place on the face because the mine was gassy. And I guess even though it was idle, there was a concern that mining equipment, even traveling by the particular idle entry, could possibly cause an ignition or something worse. Let's see, and the facts show that the inspector testified and the judge credited that the methane level in that particular entry was rising, and that they had had, and the facts also show that they had had, I guess, significant methane issues in the past months. So I think based on that and the fact that the judge made credibility findings, credited the MSHA witnesses and did not credit the company witnesses on this, and I think there's substantial evidence to support her making those credibility findings. So based on all of that, I would affirm the S&S designation. At this point, though, I'm inclined to vacate and remand on the unwarrantable failure finding. Although I may need to think about that a little bit more. It just seems to me that what the judge did here was indicate that of course this was a dangerous situation, that described it as somewhat of a chronic problem. She found that there had been some discussions with the company regarding a violation of the vent plan, Section 14D of the vent plan. But it didn't seem to me that she made findings that this particular violation, that the company either had knowledge of it, which is one of the factors. She stated that as far as the length of time it had existed was unknown, which leads me to believe that the operator may not have had knowledge. She also made a finding, though I don't know what it was based on, that the condition was obvious. But it seemed conclusory to me when she made that finding. If you base unwarrantable on, and they are factors, previous conduct or previous violations, it's just that it would seem to me that if you base it just on that, then every subsequent violation will automatically be unwarrantable. And I think I could see in a particular case that there might be some mitigating circumstances. Something happened. I mean, that caused the line curtain to, for against fall, that was not the fall of the operator, and it just so happened that the inspector came upon it just at that instant. So I at this point, I'm inclined, I guess, to remand. Vacate and remand. For her to make specific findings on obviousness and knowledge.
I have some difficulty with the S&S and this violation because think that the quality of the evidence supporting the violation assumes an awful lot in terms of whether you're going to get to that confluence of factors that was required. While the methane level was rising in this area, as the inspector found, and the evidence shows, it's still a long way from the explosive range. And, you know, in order for there to be a reasonable possibility that this discrete hazard will lead to an injury, you're going to have to get the methane there, and then you're going to have an ignition source. And I think the testimony, I found the testimony of the inspector regarding the potential ignition sources to be somewhat speculative and not especially strong. At the same time, there was also some evidence and testimony undercutting the potential danger in the face of continued mining operations, including, I believe, they were working with or redirecting some air with a fan, working on a fan to improve the ventilation, and that there had been some changes there. I don't know that that was fully accounted for. In addition to that, you have the situation where the air was in fact moving, and I recognize the 30% decrease in air movement from what's required as a minimum under this standard is certainly significant. The question remains as to whether that movement was enough not to keep the methane level from rising, but to keep it from rising to an explosive level, and I think that there was some testimony that undercut that theory. On the unwarrantable failure, I have some difficulty with this because not the kind of difficulty I have with the S&S, but with vacating it, just because it seems to me that there had been particular attention paid by the inspector in discussions with the operator to this precise problem, with the inability to keep the air moving at the level required. And when you're told pointedly it's going to get worse for you if you don't do something about it, and it doesn't get better, and it doesn't get better, it's hard to see that. However, you know, the problem I have with just affirming that is that, you know, I think on remand the judge is going to have to consider some of these factors again, from my point of view, just because I'm not sure that the degree of danger is as high as she finds it to be in this case, and I'm not sure that she fully accounted for some of the evidence that was brought to bear on the significant and substantial nature of it, which I found to undercut the finding that it was S&S. That same evidence, I think, would affect consideration of the unwarrantability. It doesn't, in my mind, mean that she could not yet again find an unwarrantable failure to comply with the standard. Recently, we had a case where I had occasion to defend the operator's position on the grounds that it's the operator's plan when you're dealing with a ventilation plan. The operator has the obligation to develop the plan and to implement a suitable plan for the mine. In this case, it's the operator's plan. If 3,000 feet per minute is unreasonable, or if a lower level is completely safe, as the operator argued, why'd you put 3,000 feet in the plan? Why'd you agree to that? To me, if you can't maintain it, you need to do something about that, and working with the district manager on modifying the plan or on doing something in the alternative to ensure that the methane is not ever going to have a possible expansion into the explosive range. If the plans are developed for a reason, a lot of thought and work goes into them. They didn't just pick 3,000 feet per minute out of a hat. So I don't think it's at all unfair to hold the operator to the standard that it put in its plan for air move. So I think I will probably go along with a remand on the unwarrantable failure, perhaps on different grounds than Commissioner Nakamura, but I think that that's something that, that might be reconsidered. But I'm not completely firm on that position because, as I said, I'm not wholly convinced that that this is not an appropriate ratcheting up in this instance of attention once the inspector has brought that attention to bear to the operator and has put the operator on notice, and I think that was done in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. I would affirm the judge's finding of S&S and unwarrantable. I think that although a judge may not check off each of the factors that the commission has found might be pertinent in determining whether a violation is unwarrantable, that each case has to be viewed on its own facts, so to speak, and sometimes it's appropriate if certain factors take on more weight in a particular case. And here, I believe the judge found that management's actions and testimony demonstrated a rather dismissive attitude toward the ventilation plan's requirement in this regard, that they had been warned by MSHR, that Superintendent McNair had testified, and the secretary points out in their brief that the superintendent had testified that in his view his job was to keep the methane levels low rather than to focus on the requirements of the ventilation plan, and that MSHR testified about their warnings to management on this problem, and the management witnesses didn't remember those warnings, and that may have suggested to the judge either a lack of candor or a lack of attention to MSHA's safety concerns. So I think that in some cases, even though a violation is not very obvious or not even be management may not be aware of at the time, if there's substantial evidence for a judge to conclude that there was a sort of dismissive attitude towards certain requirements, then that would be sufficient to support an unwarrantable failure finding, in my view. So I could uphold it in that regard.
I think I would agree that, you know, the seven factors are supposedly there to review, to look at, to determine whether or not there's aggravated conduct. Some kind, and I would agree that I guess in certain cases some factors may be so prominent that by themselves, maybe three factors, it shows aggravated conduct. I just have a problem with this particular one because it was maybe because it's a ventilation issue in an idle part of the mine where I assuming that there wasn't anybody, and you know how it came about, how the, I guess it was a curtain maybe that came down, and how that came about, and particularly with the judge finding that they did, she couldn't, it was unknown how long that situation had existed. So that's why I'm troubled with that particular finding.
May I ask a question of Commissioner Young on the S&S? So you are voting to remand or reverse?
I would reverse her on the S&S. Mm-hmm. I don't see the need to remand the issue because I think the record as it stands just doesn't support the determination. In addition to the other things I cited, if the miners have a concern, and they did and testified to that about the methane levels in the mine, I understand that we're going to consider that people will fail to do what they ought to do in a given situation. But it seems less likely, on top of everything else, that they would not perform the required methane check for starting up any equipment in these idle areas. But you know, that's just an additional thing. It wouldn't stand on its own. But.
Okay, and now we're going to move on to our final violation, which is another ventilation violation. On September 17, 2008, as Inspector Wilson walked to the face of the 15A section, the miners were moving from the number 2 entry to the number 1 entry. He observed 2 miners attempting to hook a bologna skin, in quotes, to the back of a fan in order to direct air. When they could not successfully hook the skin, they dropped it and returned to their other job. Their actions caused a short circuit of air, which in turn blew down a ventilating curtain in the number 2 entry. There was not enough airflow at the end of the line canvas to spin the wheel of Inspector Wilson's anemometer. Wilson found a 1% methane and testified that if left unabated, the methane would continue to accumulate and reach explosive levels. As a result, he issued citation number 8014053, alleging an SNF violation for failing to maintain 3,000 CFM of air pursuant to the ventilation plan. Because the violation was admitted by counsel, the judge determined that the violation occurred as stated in the citation. As to SNF, the judge found that a discrete safety hazard existed as a result of the violation, which was the danger of respirable dust in the air, as well as methane accumulation resulting in explosion. She found that the hazard described would result in an injury of a serious or fatal nature, thus fulfilling the Matthews SNS element. The judge credited Inspector Wilson's testimony that the condition created by the violation, the accumulation of methane in an area with ignition sources easily accessible, would result in an injury-causing event. The judge also raised the negligence from low to moderate because she said the mine disregarded MSHA inspector's instructions regarding the section of the medicine when the mine was experienced high levels of methane and failed to ensure that miners were aware of the vent plan requirements. Accordingly, the judge raised the penalty from $7,578 proposed by the secretary to $10,000. On appeal, Consol argues that the violation was not SNS because the methane levels were far below what is necessary for an explosion. It further insists that there was no SNS violation because all the equipment was in permissible condition and that the operator would have made pre-operational checks before energizing any of the equipment. Further, the inspector, Consol argues that the inspector only speculated that the methane levels would have risen. Consol also takes issue with the judge increasing the level of negligence from low to moderate. Consol asserts that this was a temporary situation and that no one in Consol's management knew or could have known of the situation. Consol asserts that there was no evidence in the record to support a higher negligence finding. The secretary responds that the judge's SNS finding is supported by substantial evidence. She asserts that Consol disregards the well-established precedent that SNS determinations must be made in the context of continued mining operations. Inspector Wilson testified that he found 1% methane in a 130-foot area in a very short period and that he believed methane would build up in a very short period of time, and that even Consol's witnesses testified that methane on that section was generally high. The inspector testified that there were ignition sources in the area and that Consol had a high number of permissibility violations. The secretary also asserts that the judge's moderate negligence finding is also supported by substantial evidence given Consol's history of Section 14D vent plan violations, that MSHA's July 30th, 2008 warning that Consol needed to make greater efforts at compliance, the dangerous nature of the violation, and that management should have made miners aware of the vent problems in idle areas. The secretary asserts that the commission has held an operator supervision training of rank and file miners is relevant in determining negligence. And so now we'll go to Commissioner.
So this is the hypothetical case I was talking about. Because, and the MSHA inspector didn't designate it as unwarrantable.
So yeah.
But
he just raised the negligence.
Right, yeah. And this particular...
No, the inspector didn't do that. The judge raised it.
Judge raised it, yeah.
Excuse me, Beth, what is the number? I just want to make sure I'm on the right pages here. Flip it. The number of this citation? This is two.
Sure. The... This is citation number
801-4053.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, for the reason on the S&S issue, for the reasons I stated earlier with respect to the other ventilation violation, I would affirm the S&S finding here. In this particular case, there was no observable air at all in the second entry. In this same 15A section where they were having all the methane problems. And I guess the methane was measured all the way up to 1%, halfway up the entry, and there was equipment in the area. And again, the 3,000 CFM requirement recognized that there could be equipment in use going across the entry and as ignition sources, possible ignition sources. So I think for all the reasons I stated earlier, I would affirm the S&S. I haven't made up my mind on the increase in the negligence finding. I know that it's based on substantial evidence, and I guess I need to think about that. There's probably substantial evidence to support the increase. I might not have increased it, but that's not for me to find. But I guess I'd like to give that some more thought as to whether or not at least there's substantial evidence to support the finding. Negligence is kind of a squishy concept, and as far as low, moderate, high, very high. So. I'm not as familiar with that area of the law, so I'd like to give it some thought.
I would affirm on the S&S, and I think this citation stands in stark contrast to the other one, where I would reverse the S&S. Here you had the inspector unequivocally testify that if unabated, the methane level would rise to the explosive level. So you have that factor of the equation. You have clear and uncontroverted testimony about there being ignition sources. To the extent that there was controversy there, the judge is entitled to find that the permissibility issues were not universal. And as Commissioner Nakamura noted in the previous U.S. Steel case, we found permissible equipment can still be considered an ignition source and upheld for S&S purposes. So I would affirm on the S&S and find that the confluence of factors was made out here and supported by substantial evidence in that case. Considering the rise in the negligence, substantial evidence may be comprised entirely of circumstantial evidence. And in this case, when you have miners doing something that's important to the ventilation plan, and when they're not able to do it, just giving up, and then you see the impact of that downstream, it's an indication that they either don't know or don't care about the importance of their action or lack of action as it affects the integrated ventilation system for the mine. And the difficulty that caused in this case and the problems that were created could have been addressed by better training, supervision, and communication by the operator. And, you know, the real art of leadership, as President Eisenhower once observed, is it's not getting people to do what you want them to do, it's getting them to want to do what you want them to do. And in this case, I don't believe that the miners had the inclination that it was necessary for them to continue to work on this, and if unable to get the baloney skin attached, to contact somebody in their supervisor chain, say, we're having a problem here. We need to do something about this. And again, it's the operator's plan. They need to get everybody on board supporting that plan and making sure that they don't encounter these types of problems with the ventilation. It does make you wonder. They keep having problems with the ventilation system. How much of it might be related to this type of inattention, not necessarily by mine management at the micro level, but at the macro level, so that you get the miners engaged in the undertakings necessary to ensure that the plan is successful. So I would affirm the increase in the negligence. It's not such a huge leap in my mind. Talking about low negligence, it's not as though she said, I'm going to find this to be an unwarrantable, or I'm going to find it to be high negligence in this case. I don't think she could really get to an unwarrantable here with the actions of rank and file miners. But you know, she's making what she considers to be a measured increase in the culpability of the operator for failing to ensure that people understand and implement the parts of the plan. And I believe, based on the record, that she's entitled to do that, even though, as Commissioner Nakamura noted, she's certainly not required to do it, and perhaps I would not have in her position. But for the reasons that I've set out there, I don't think it's an unreasonable leap for her to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. I would affirm the judge's finding of S&S and this violation. I'm inclined to affirm her increase in penalty based on her consideration of the negligence factor. I may continue to take a look at the record in this regard and think about it, but I think she, on the one hand, seemed to maybe have a bit of an erroneous view of the legal nature of ascribing negligence, where she stated that in the instant case, any negligence on the part of the miners who changed the ventilation by moving the fan is attributed to the operator. The commission hasn't necessarily taken that view, you know, that any negligence on rank and file miners is attributed to the operator. But she basically also took into account in raising the negligence factor that it is the operator's ultimate responsibility to make sure that miners do understand the requirements of the ventilation plan and appreciate the importance of it. And I think she could have been and was probably affected by her earlier findings and conclusions that the management at this mine indeed did not take requirements of the ventilation plan seriously. I think there's some of the briefs pointing to some conversation or statements that certain management officials just felt, well, they just had to keep methane at a certain point. They didn't really have to focus on the requirements of the plan. So I think that I would, at this point, affirm her increase in the negligence, although I think there was a little bit of a, her statement is a little confusing in that one regard about the view of attributing the negligence.
All right.
Thank you, Beth. At this point, I think before we go on to our next case, we should take a 10-minute break to yourself.